Hi, Kirsty Melville here. Welcome to this latest episode of Earshot. Today we're talking about islands. Now, for obvious reasons, islands have long been used as places of quarantine and detention. Just think Alcatraz, Robben's Island, Devil's Island, even Western Australia's Rottnest Island. And Adelaide's Torrens Island is another. It lies in the Port River estuary, close to the city, and access to it is currently restricted because it's home to the city's main power plant. But one way to get there is by kayak. So today, producer Mike Ladd paddles out into the Port River to discover that Torrens Island has a dark past.
For years, I've been kayaking around Torrens Island with my friend, the writer and nature lover, Pat Irvine.
Look, Pat, dolphin, 12 o'clock. There he is. Look, he's close now. See, he's coming straight between us.
Oh, it's two youngies. Oh, there's Mum.
Right between us. You can hear him breathing.
Torrens Island is a low, tear-shaped landmass in the industrial landscape of Adelaide's Port River estuary. Home to an old quarantine station and the city's main power plant, it's fringed with mangroves and crisscrossed by tidal creeks.
And we're just going to slip into this mangrove creek into the interior of Torrens Island. Like a beautiful forest, miniature forest underneath the trees of these new metaphors. Thousands of these little, I don't know, 30 centimetre high spikes and the dappled light. So how long have you been coming to Torrens Island?
Maybe 35 years off and on.
Wow.
A lot of it was very on because I ran a kayak touring business for 10 years in here.
I've always thought of the island as a romantic place of dolphins and bird life, another green world to love and explore, blissfully unaware that it was also a concentration camp.
Did you know that this place was a prison camp?
Yes, yes. Depressing, isn't it? Possibly relatives of mine. I'm three quarters Irish and a quarter German. Yes, we're very good at concentration camps, aren't we? I think we've improved on it. If improve is the word. And I think not.
Historians Peter Monteith and Mandy Paul have collaborated on a book called Interned, which includes some extraordinary photos of life in the Torrens Island concentration camp, and letters from prisoners.
The transport leader refused us permission to smoke because we were singing Die Wacht am Rhein when the train started moving. In Adelaide, we changed trains for Port Adelaide. As I could only walk slowly because of my heavy luggage, Sergeant M jabbed me in my side with his rifle butt. The whole day long, we were able to feed our empty stomachs with just one bread roll. In the cold, pitch-black night, we had to walk from the Port Adelaide station to the harbour. Singing, we climbed aboard a little boat, and we sang as we travelled across the water to Torrens Island, the Devil's Island.
Torrens Island opened as an internment camp or concentration camp, as was the language of the day, in October of 1914, so sometime after the outbreak of the war in August. There were altogether about 400 people, all of them men, who were interned on Torrens Island. They came from different backgrounds, but the majority were German. We found one Turk as well who was interned there, and then there were some who were from Austria-Hungary. So a good variety. And initially, they were especially interested in interning young German men because the fear was that if they weren't detained in Australia, then they might go back to Germany and serve in the war.
On Torrens, we found 314 Germans and Austrians already there. Some sympathetic souls among them gave us something to eat. This was now the third night on which I had not been able to change my clothes. In a state of exhaustion, I sank down into my place on the sandy ground, thought of my Gwen and of other dear friends, until sleep pulled me from my heavy lamentations and embraced me in its charitable arms.
Torrens Island was well suited because as an island it offered possibilities of security, isolation that were superior to any other possibility.
And that's also consistent with what happened around Australia. So locations such as Bruny Island in Tasmania, Rottnest Island in Western Australia, places that had often already been used for some other form of containment, so like Torrens Island had been used as a quarantine station. People might not think of Torrens Island as remote, given that it's in the Port River estuary, but it is remote in terms of getting there.
I learned that to date, three prisoners had attempted to escape and one of them had drowned in the process. Because of the danger of sharks, it is extremely difficult and daring to make a successful escape and brave the waters. Oh, how barren it is here. No houses, no flowers. Sand, sand, and a miserable bit of bush. Martin Trojan.
Torrens Island is a low-lying, mangrovey, sandy island. It's quite desolate in a way. It would have been very cold during the winter and probably fairly blistering in the summer. The camp at both its locations relied mainly on canvas. It was mainly a tent city, and it was very makeshift.
Owing our tent being small and very inconvenient to use it as bedroom, kitchen and dining room combined, we were forced to procure bags at 4 pence apiece, old potato bags. Went out into the bush under guard, procured some sticks, and we soon had a rough and ready bush kitchen and dining room. Our kitchen contained a fireplace made out of a few stones and mud, to which a few iron bars were added for the pots to stand on. The cook only had to lift the lid of the cooking pot when a handful of sand were laying on top of the stew instead of the necessary pepper. Frank Bungardi.
The men were in tents of about 8.
They just slept on the ground. Bungardi says, snuggled up together like pigs in a sty. They were issued with the makings of a mattress and a waterproof sheet. It was probably more comfortable to sleep snuggled up than it was to try and sleep separately, partly because of the size, but also you'd get some warmth that way.
The camp had two locations on the island, the first just south of the old quarantine station. Today I meet Peter Winkler near the jetty, where weary passengers whose ships were given the yellow flag of contagion trudged down to be showered and fumigated. There's a danger cyanide sign on one building and a creepy industrial shower block.
The first people to be quarantined here were actually for scarlet fever. But also around about the turn of the 20th century, there were various cases of plague which occurred in not only in Adelaide but also in Sydney. And those people were actually brought out here for quarantine purposes.
So we're talking bubonic plague here?
Yes, yeah. There are a couple of burials in the cemetery of those plague victims.
Behind the dilapidated isolation wards and the old mortuary is an unassuming tower.
Just behind those trees, behind where the mortuary is a radio antenna, which apparently is a bit of spookery associated with that. It apparently it's part of the government's monitoring network of radio communications.
You mean it's still going?
Oh, yes. But again, it's something we haven't heard very much about. It's fairly mysterious.
If you tell me, you'll have to kill me.
I don't know. My clearance level isn't that high. So where we are now is several hundred metres south of the quarantine station, and it's an area where there's a bit more extensive sand dune. And I think that this is probably the location of the internment camp that was set up in 1915.
And it's quite low lying here. We've got water lying around. I can imagine this flooding during winter.
To avoid infection from the quarantine station, and also because of the flooding, the tent city surrounded by barbed wire was moved to a second location on the island, in what is now the switchyard of Adelaide's main power station. The day we visit the plant, a great wind has sprung up from the Southern Ocean, chasing clouds across the island and making the power lines sing. An electronic map in the front office shows most of the state's energy is flowing in from its wind farms.
Today we've got 2B units on and no A units.
Mm-hmm.
We're probably just there for system stability. We're not actually making any money. Yeah, the wind's 10 times what
we
are.
10 times.
Yeah. But middle of summer when the wind doesn't blow and it's a very hot day, the state will need us.
All right,
enjoy
the
visit.
Thank you.
Thanks. Jeff Levitt takes us on a tour of the boiler rooms and the turbine hall. But what I'm really interested in is getting to the southeast corner of the station, where the concentration camp was.
There was one Christmas we had an operator on the rounds on night shift and he radioed in. There was a deer in the car park, which we thought was appropriate at Christmas, and you know, we didn't. A bit of a worry, but story after that, we found out apparently with the quarantine station years ago, there's a herd of deer down there, and a couple of them got out, so there was still one floating around the island somewhere. So it was just funny at the time, you know, on the night shift, you know, on Christmas, you know, there was a deer in the car park. I'm sure there is, you know.
Everyone thought it was Rudolph.
Well,
did it have a red nose?
Oh, that's what we're worried about.
This here basically is probably the tail end of production, so this is what all the power station's about, is to make electricity. So these are the big transformers called step-up transformers. They step the voltage up from the generation voltage out of the machine up to 275,000 volts, and it goes out into these switch yards here.
Which is actually the site of the second concentration camp during the First World War. This is where it was. It's now a forest of insulators and basically feeding out to all the substations in Adelaide.
Thank you.
One of the best sources of information about the camp is the diary of Frank Bungardi.
If the reporter of the Advertiser or Herald, two leading South Australian newspapers, had wended his way on a fine afternoon to Torrens Island and had taken the trouble to inquire about our treatment, he would have been astonished. He would have heard true complaints enough to fill a column for a week of true misery and sufferings endured by prisoners of war in their own land.
Frank Bungardi was born in Germany. Before the war, he appears in the newspapers under the nickname the Iron Jawed German or the Bun. He's a pugilist, a boxer. He also makes a living working in the mines, so he was working in Broken Hill when he was interned.
The news to consider myself under arrest, of course, were a great shock at first, especially as I had a wife and children at home awaiting father's return from work. I were permitted to go home to get some personal effects, the time granted being half an hour. Owing the short time allowance, my goodbye to the dear ones I were forced to leave behind were a short one. Heavy-hearted in charge of a detective, I left my home, a weeping wife, and my weeping children, bound for the railway station to catch the Adelaide Express.
The other thing that might be worth mentioning about Bungardi is that he was married to an Australian woman, an Australian-born woman, and he had a brother-in-law who served in the AIF and was killed at Gallipoli in August of 1915.
None of that stood him in any stead.
Another source of information about life in the concentration camp was Paul Dubotsky, who left behind a remarkable collection of photographs.
Paul Dubotsky was a German-born, a Bavarian-born photographer. There are gaps in his story. We know that he was taking part in an expedition through Southeast Asia just before the war, and at the outbreak of war, it seems he was in New Guinea. We're not sure how, but he turns up in Adelaide after the beginning of the war, and he works in Adelaide as a photographer. He runs a small studio, and then he becomes one of the interned. That happens in early 1915. And although they decide that he has to be detained for security reasons, they allow him to keep his camera and his photographic equipment, with the result that through the period of his detention on Torrens Island and beyond then in New South Wales, he keeps his camera, he works with it, and he produces a truly wonderful photographic record of Torrens Island and of the Trial Bay camp. I think he must have got on quite well with both inmates and guards. So the guards were happy to be photographed by him, which is fortunate. And I think that was the way that he operated. He didn't present himself as a threat, unlike Bungardi, who was not happy with circumstances and complained bitterly and wrote letters that were stopped by the censor. My suspicion is that Dubotsky was someone who accommodated himself to the circumstances that prevailed.
Because it seems almost incredible that the military would let somebody wander around the camp with a camera, documenting everything.
And not just that, set up a studio where he sold copies of his images.
Dubotsky was allowed to have a dark room on the island, bringing his chemicals over on the supply boat from Adelaide. He printed and sold portraits and postcards of camp life to his fellow prisoners and even the guards.
We were very lucky that that was the case because we were able to assemble digital copies of his postcards and images from a range of collections. So they got a bit spread around, which helped ensure their survival.
Dubotsky's ingenuity was typical of the German prisoners on the island. They built their own coffee shop from scrap wood and hessian and named it the Kaiser Cafe.
They were very enterprising. Clearly some of them had the capacity to bring in some goods from outside, even though they lived in very isolated circumstances. And I think the biggest challenge for them was to pass the time in some useful kind of way. So to run a cafe was a business enterprise of sorts. It was a way of socialising. There were other businesses too. There was Dubotsky's photographic studio. And at one point, according to the camp newspaper, there was not just one, but there were two tattoo parlours.
The prisoners also published three issues of their own hand-drawn newspaper.
It was called Der Kamerad, and there's ads in this newspaper. The whole back page of one issue is an ad for Dubotsky's studio, and you can buy postcards. It tells you how much they cost and so on.
Among the stories and drawings of Der Kamerad, one inmate announced he was opening a flying school, and another offered to build ships and submarines. Dubotsky's business address is given with some irony as Hauptstrasse, Main Street, Torrens Island. There was also an athletic club.
Dubotsky captures beautifully, I think, and it's some testament to his skill as a photographer, the activities of the gymnasts on the island. These were mainly young, fit men, and they were keen to preserve their health, preserve their fitness as best they could. And this too was a way for them to socialise, to try to create some meaning for their lives during a period which was otherwise full of frustration.
There were several musical groups as well.
There was a choir and there was more than one band. There was a sailors band which had accordions and mouth organs and a kettle drum and so on. And there was also a brass band.
Many a long weary hour during the hot evenings we amused ourselves, laying in a circle in the soft sand, enjoying German ballads, ditties, soldiers and national songs. If it hadn't been for this, there would have been a few more driven mad.
Surreally, to celebrate the Kaiser's birthday, the prisoners organised parades and dances in the sand, with some of the men dressed as women.
There were six men who had been transformed into courtly ladies for the occasion, and it really must have taken some skill. There was a tailor in the camp who helped make those dresses. They made wigs out of dyed mineral rope, fabulous-looking hats out of wire and paper with flowers on them. A really interesting expression of, you know, creativity.
We fancied ourselves holding a court lady in our arms and waltzing around the Emperor's palace until the heavy sandy ground reminded us that we were on Australian soil. The handsome lady, a fellow sufferer like ourselves.
Meanwhile, their real womenfolk and children were also suffering. Often frozen out of work, some were destitute.
Will you please give me a weekly allowance of 10 shillings for my daughter and me? We have tried to continue in our home as my husband's wages were stopped once he was taken away from us. I am nearly 50 years of age and cannot earn anything. Ottilie Goers.
Okay, we're right in front of the switchyard now, which was the site for the second detention camp. And there is the old loading jetty. What's left of it which is where people were allowed to have very brief interchanges with their loved ones while they unloaded supplies. That little narrow plank jetty is it, and it's now all grown over by mangrove. There would have been some really desperate meetings on that. So let's go and have a closer look at this jetty.
What made me write is because my father, who is very dear to me, is down there too, and I wish you to have a bit of mercy and let him out. I'm yours truly, Miss Anna Hosh. Please, let me have him back. It is breaking my heart.
No access, jetty structure unsafe. Yeah, it's just a wonderfully wobbly old pile of rotted wood. And sharp nails. And just the remains of some planks. This is where they stood.
And you've been listening to part one of Torrens Island Concentration. Our readers were Andrea Sobig, Susanna Scheck and Gabrielle Fitzgerald. We also heard from Patricia Irvine, Peter Monteith, Mandy Paul, Peter Winkler and Jeff Levitt. Original music was by Jakub Gadaszynski. The sound engineer was Tom Henry and production was by Mike Ladd. The book Interned, Torrens Island is published by Wakefield Press, and you'll find all the information about it on our website, where you can also see some of the amazing archival photos that Paul Dubotsky took during his time in the detention camp. And you can listen to part two of our series on Torrens Island right now. It's coming up next in your podcast feed, or you'll find it online. And this is when things start to get a bit hairy on the island, taking a dramatic turn for the worse when Captain Hawkes arrives and the prisoners start fearing for their lives. I'm Kirsty Melville, and I'll catch you then.